Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 19th of August, my husband's birthday. He's not up yet, but I wish him a happy birthday. We're 3 days apart in age. I'm the older woman. Jonathan Alter is our guest this hour, and he is right here in studio. I feel like I'm doing a television show. Yeah, here is Jonathan Alter. He is he's a wonderful, and I've told him this, how much I respect his work. He's one of those people I love to listen to. He is author, and we talked to him recently about The Promise, President Obama, Year One. He is an award-winning columnist and a television analyst and author. He has written on an acclaimed Newsweek column, and we'll talk to him about the future of Newsweek during this hour, examining politics, media, social, and global issues. We also interviewed him about his 2006 book, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, which is a national bestseller. He has appeared on Today, NBC Nightly News, Meet the Press, NBC News Specials, MSNBC, where he's somewhat a regular, and CNBC. He appears twice weekly on Countdown with Keith Olbermann on MSNBC. And he is the guy, Jonathan is, who went on the air to break the story about those butterfly ballots in Florida that helped shape the outcome of the election. He's speaking tonight. Let me give you this info because he's well worth hearing. I know Irish Fest is starting tonight, but you can always do that tomorrow and over the weekend. Tonight at 7 o'clock at the Todd Ware Theater on the campus of Concordia University on Lakeshore Drive in Mequon. It's part of Next Chapter's ongoing author series. The ticket price of $32, a bargain because you get a signed copy of the book. And tickets can be purchased in advance online by going to nextchapterbookshop.com or go to the bookstore in Mequon. Seating is first come, first served, and it's going to be a whale of a good evening. Our phone number for this, and we have almost all our lines filled already, is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. But first things first, baseball. He has just informed us that he's throwing out the first ball at the Cubs game tomorrow, and he's a lifelong Cubs fan. He, and I'm from Chicago as well, but I'm a White Sox fan, but I just found out that he is as well.
I know I'm in enemy territory.
I'm really a Brewers fan, though. So we were talking.
I like the Brewers, too, but the Cubs are first in my
mind. I understand.
I grew up very close to the ballpark, so it would be a traitor if I wasn't still a Cubs fan.
I know. We were talking about what he should wear. So if you have a suggestion of what he should wear as he does this monumental thing, which must be very frightening. Here's a guy who's on television all the time and writes all these wonderful books, great historian, but throwing out a ball at Cubs game.
This is terrifying to me. You know, a few weeks ago I went on David Letterman. I've been on a bunch of these other shows, the Today Show, you know, Colbert and so forth. And none of them are nearly as frightening as getting up on that mound, because I know if I throw the ball in the dirt, it'll be on YouTube and all my friends will laugh at me. So I have to get it. I don't have to get it over the plate, but I can't throw a ground ball.
Right. And you're a hometown guy, too.
That's right.
So everybody's
I've got all my
be
friends and family
you.
Who are coming to the ballpark.
Yeah. So. You wrote a piece. I guess I'll start with this as long as we're on baseball. Back in 2008, you were taking your children to a Cubs game, which you do frequently, I'm sure. But I like this line, and I want to know more. You learned half of what you know about life from the bleacher bums at the Chicago Cubs games.
Well, I grew up in the 1960s, six blocks away from Wrigley Field. And in those days, a ticket that now costs, $100, cost $1 to sit in the bleachers. And my late mother would make me a brown bag lunch and in exchange for some chores that I did around the house, she would give me a dollar for admission and a quarter for a frosty malt. And I would go to the ballpark with a friend at about 10 o'clock in the morning, start watching batting practice, whatever was going on. And we would basically stay there all day. I'd spend my summers doing this, starting at age 9 or 10, because this was day baseball. I was mentioning to you before we went on the air, the very first game I ever went to was in 1965, and it was the Cubs versus the Milwaukee Braves. But what my mother didn't know, my parents didn't know, was that there were these folks called bleacher bums who later became famous, who corrupted me. And I learned, and these were people who worked at night, people who were unemployed. It was the first lesbians I ever met. They were among the bleacher bums. There was a lot of drinking, a lot of cursing, a lot of smart talk about sports and politics. You know, that's how I learned about the world.
Yeah, that's not a bad way to learn about the world. I'm interested. I love the book that you did, and it's really been getting and even this wonderful Frank Rich piece. You must have been pleased with
what he wrote. Yeah, because Frank's a tough critic.
He is a tough critic. Yeah, I always read him, too. I watch you. I read you. I read Frank Rich all the time, too, because I think he's great. But I was interested in this meeting when we're talking about big moments. You had face-to-face time with the president when you wrote this book. And I'd love for you to talk about that. What happened during that time?
Well, I'll tell you first a kind of a funny story that I think that I did not put in the book because I was trying to write kind of instant history, and I didn't want to inject myself in the book. I think there's too much first person in all these books, and you know, the president told me, and as I walked into the Oval Office, and you know, and so I just don't have any of that in the promise. But just for you and the audience, I interviewed him shortly after. It's just the day before he gave his West Point speech on Afghanistan, announcing his new policy on Afghanistan. And I knew as I was walking into the Oval Office that you get a very, very short amount of time to engage in small talk. He's businesslike. It's a good thing, but you get a minute 30, 2 minutes maybe. And I didn't want to spend any more time than that anyway because I didn't know how long it would be before he threw me out. It turned out I was in there for 40 minutes. But so as we're circling the couch on the way in before we sit down, I come up with a really imaginative small talk question. So how was your Thanksgiving, Mr. President? And he says, it was great. We went to the Oregon State George Washington basketball game, and his brother-in-law, Craig Robinson, Michelle's brother, is the coach of Oregon State. And, you know, the game was great. Oregon State won. The only problem was Michelle's mother my mother-in-law kept punching me every time the game got close because she was so nervous. And I said, you know, stop punching me. You're hurting me. And second of all, if you don't stop punching me, the Secret Service is going to haul you out of here. So I said, then by this time we're sitting down and he's in that wingback chair that you see on TV. And I said, you know, Mr. President, my son goes to George Washington, and he's going to be assistant manager of the basketball team next year. And
really?
He said, your son, the one that I met? And I told him, I said, yeah. And he said, he's already in college? And I told him a very quick story, because I knew the clock was ticking, that when I had interviewed him in 2004, at which point he had been elected but not yet sworn into the United States Senate. He was still technically an Illinois state senator, and I did a cover story on him in Newsweek. It was the first magazine cover he'd ever been on. And I brought my son down, who was then 13 years old, Tommy Alter, to the game, to the interview. And after the interview, as we were going, leaving the interview, Tommy said, Dad, that guy's going to be president in 2008. And I said in a patronizing way, Tommy, when you've covered politics as long as I have, you'll know he can't possibly be president in 2008. You know, he doesn't know where the men's room in the Senate is yet. And maybe 2016, but that's a long shot. So I tell this story to the president, and he says, well, you tell Tommy two things. So you say hello to him for me. You tell him he should have talked me out of it. And then he says, because he knew there was a reporter there, said, joke. That's a joke. And then he said, and this was unmistakable, and this is very much part of Obama, okay. And that was the signal that it was time to move from small talk to a very serious interview about Afghanistan and health care and the Recovery Act and the rest of what was on his agenda, and that interview is actually bundled with the audio book of The Promise, so people, if they're interested, can hear
interview. But I didn't have that. I didn't get that.
But not it's with the audio book.
You've got, it's with the audio book.
Yeah, you've got the
I've got the other book.
You've got the hardcover.
Okay.
But most of the quotes are in the book in various places. But not the story that I just told you.
Oh, that's a wonderful story, Jonathan. And wonderful for your son to remember that for his whole life as well. Well, then we need to move into some of the heavy stuff.
I'm sorry. I gave a light answer to your question.
Perfect timing. Way to go into
but,
and I wanted to start with you with Jobs, because you wrote the book about FDR, too, and we just got back from Minnesota, where you're constantly seeing what he did as a result of the Civilian Conservation Corps and all these jobs created. Why doesn't the president jumpstart the economy with a jobs program? Why is that something that doesn't happen? And today we get more news that the economy, still the jobs aren't being created. Why doesn't he do something big?
I agree with you. I think that he needed to do what's called direct hiring. You know, the $787 billion stimulus, which passed just a few weeks after he took office in 2009, the Recovery Act, was a much more impressive piece of legislation than it's given credit for. It was far more public investment in his first year in constant dollars than Franklin Roosevelt made in his first year. Now, this is a little known fact. The reason I know it is because, as you know, I wrote a book about Franklin Roosevelt's first year. So it wasn't until later that we got the WPA and these other big programs. And even the CCC that you mentioned, the Civilian Conservation Corps, it was 250,000 young people working, building trails and clearing brush and doing amazing things in our country. It's precisely the same number as were authorized by Obama's National Service Bill, 250,000 more for AmeriCorps. But there was so much going on in 2009 that many of these things were not understood. And the stimulus was, just in terms of job creation, it was the largest infrastructure spending since the Interstate Highway Act of the 1950s. It was the largest education bill since the 1960s. It doubled medical and scientific research funding. It had a $300 billion tax cut as part of it for the middle class. So this was a huge, messy piece of legislation, which they did, I think, a pretty awful job of framing and selling. They traded speed for, you know, communicating what it was about. They needed to get it through. They didn't want to. The Republicans, all of whom in the House voted against it, and all but three, if you include Specter, voted against it in the Senate. They were picking it apart from day one. There was no honeymoon. Remember, on January 21st, 2009, they were already picking apart the Recovery Act, the stimulus. And so it was politically contentious from the beginning. Some liberals say it should have been bigger, and that's easy to say in retrospect. But at the time, it was much bigger than even very liberal Democrats thought was politically possible. So Governor Rendell, for instance, who's of Pennsylvania, who's the big infrastructure man, he thought that a $350 billion stimulus would have been like beyond his wildest expectations. In the middle of 2008, the number they were talking about was $150 billion. They ended up with $787 billion stimulus, a lot of the effects of which were only now being felt. There's not enough permanent changes like the New Deal brought in the bill that, you know, projects that we can really remember. I mean, there's some high-speed rail. But anything you do, just like with FDR, they call it a boondoggle. So they want to do high-speed rail between Madison and Milwaukee. Republicans are saying that's a boondoggle. But when you invest in those sorts of projects, you not only create jobs, you create radiating economic growth, because those sorts of projects generate their own economic activity. So I think they should have done more direct hiring, but they thought that the money would be spent faster by doing it with contracting out the work. The president recently has said that there is going to be another big infrastructure bill. A lot of the projects are not sexy. They're sewage, you know, systems for your town.
We can use that here.
And I don't know how specifically how Wisconsin did on sewage, but a lot of communities got a lot of money for that kind of thing in the stimulus. And it was not done by pork. That's all just untrue. There were no earmarks in the stimulus. Anybody who says there were is not telling the truth. But that doesn't mean that all the money is going to be well spent either. And when you're spending this amount of money, there are going to be, you know, bad choices along the way. They did manage. I think it's probably the most underrated piece of legislation in modern American history. If it had been split up into five or six bills, people would appreciate it a lot more. And the main reason people don't appreciate it is because we still have, you know, 9.7% unemployment. Yeah. Now you can say, and that's intolerable, and I'm not rationalizing it in any way. But I do think, in the interest of history, it's important to understand that this president and this Congress prevented another Great Depression, and this is not a and the Federal Reserve as well. This is not a piece of spin. At the time Obama took office in January of 2009, the economy was losing 750,000 jobs a month. If we had stayed on that pace, by the end of 2009, we would have been in another Great Depression without exaggeration.
That's a very big thing you just said. Millions and
millions of people unemployed. Now, just to give people a sense, we're adding about 100,000 to 200,000 jobs a month. That's anemic. It's not enough. We're a long way from getting where we need to be in terms of bringing unemployment down. But if we hadn't stopped the bleeding, we would have had 20% unemployment if we had just stayed on that same pace. And the economy was showing no signs that it was going to restore itself without vigorous action by the government, which is what we got. People said that money that we gave to the banks, we'll never see it. It's all been paid back with interest.
Right.
Bailing out the auto companies, what a disaster. Government Motors, why does Obama want to run an auto company? Which he didn't. They're now back on their feet. So I do think that people have to look at the record. It is a mixed record. There are disappointments there, you know. I happen to be a single-payer man myself, you know. But the health care bill, the biggest piece of social legislation in 45 years since Medicare and Medicaid. Many, many important things in that bill that got very little discussion.
So is part of the problem, then, that we live in this age, and you've written about this, too, that they need some sound bites. You know, we don't like them, but that's the way this country operates right now. And they have simply not been on message, because you say that, and the Republicans are very good at coming up with the phrases and having people be fearful of big government taking over. When you list some of those, be you a Republican or a Democrat, you have to admit that it's a pretty decent record of accomplishment. Why is it that the administration can't keep telling us this is a pretty decent record of accomplishment?
Well, they're starting to do that. I'm pretty critical of the president in the promise on the communications front. I thought that the big surprise to me was we expected him to ace communications and struggle in executive leadership because he had no experience to speak of, and it turned out to be the reverse. He has struggled to frame a message and done extremely well behind closed doors. The promise is really about taking people behind those closed doors and telling them what happens when the cameras are off, and the reports are very, very positive. Not entirely so. I mean, it's warts and all, my book, but people who deal with him in private are very impressed by the guy. But the public part, very problematic. I think what he did was he overlearned Mario Cuomo's famous lesson, which was that you campaign in poetry and govern in prose. And he campaigned in poetry.
He sure did.
Then he started governing in prose, and he forgot that you got to govern with some poetry too. And he didn't want to raise people's expectations with too much poetry, but he's been allergic to sound bites, and it really has hurt him. It's easy to dump on sound bites, but that's how we communicate. And also, we've always done it that way. You know, when Abraham Lincoln said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand," that was a sound bite. you know, or the only thing we have to fear itself, was a soundbite. Now, so I've been very critical of him on this. I think recently he's gotten better as he's gone into campaign mode. And you might be familiar with this automotive soundbite that he's been using, you know, where he says they drove the car into the ditch. Now they want us to give them the keys. No way, you know. And he actually milks the story and gets a really great crowd response from saying, you know, D is drive, R for Republican is reverse. And so he's figuring it out now, whether it's too late. Whether the midterm elections are kind of baked in the cake already, and people are so angry that they'll throw the Democrats out, I don't know. It's highly unlikely the Democrats will lose the Senate, but the House is up for grabs, and Wisconsin is very much a battleground. So
yes,
you can look at people like Steve Kagan, who I mentioned.
Who's your cousin?
Yeah, I'm related
to.
You
know that.
But, you know, he's I'm biased, but I think he's a terrific congressman from the Green Bay area. And he but he's in a pretty conservative district. So he's in some ways kind of one of those bellwether members, if he has a good night and he gets reelected, he was first elected in 2006, then that will be a sign that the Democrats will hold the House. If you see Kagan go down early in the evening, that's a pretty decent sign that it's going to be a long night for the Democrats.
I'll watch that race. Is Obama, people always said this about Clinton, and I know you've written about this too, is Obama always the smartest guy in the room?
You know, a lot of the time, both he and Clinton are the smartest guys in the room. I think you can say on both of their behalves that they don't have to prove it, which is a really important distinction. And there are some very smart politicians I've covered who always have to prove it. And that's something that neither Clinton nor Obama suffers from. Their minds work very differently. They make decisions in very different ways. I got fascinated by this. I've got a chapter in The Promise called The Un-Bubba, where I contrast their temperaments and their operating styles. But both of them are highly intelligent very good at drawing on the intelligence of others. Clinton's intelligence is more connective. I think of him as having an inductive horizontal intelligence, and Obama's having a deductive vertical intelligence. Obama's much more decisive, which in a crisis is helpful. Clinton ruminates more and can sometimes get to more creative connections and policy solutions. And also, I think Clinton was better at bringing in a wider circle, particularly on economic issues, where the stakes were not as high for Clinton, but he had a wider circle. And I'm critical of Obama for not using his leverage over the banks last year when he had it, and having a wider circle of advice on the economy.
We'll talk more about that in a moment. And welcome phone calls. We have many of them. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Jonathan Alter is our guest in our downtown Milwaukee studios today. He's going to be speaking tonight at 7 o'clock at Concordia University at, you know, I've lived here how many years, and I'd never know how to pronounce these huge numbers. 12800 North Lakeshore Drive in Mequon. He'll be part of the Next Chapter's ongoing author series. Ticket price, $32. You get a signed copy of the book, and you can get tickets in advance online. All you have to do is go to Next Chapter Altogether Bookshop, nextchapterbookshop.com, and seating is first come, first served. So we'll be with you momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program today, Paul Bloom, will be with us, professor of psychology at Yale University and author. His latest book is, he's a prolific guy, How Pleasure Works, The New Science of Why We Like What We Like. Lest you think this is pop psychology, it is not. He starts the book with why people like cannibalism. So you may not want to eat during the second hour of our program. We've had him on before. He's a great guest. Jonathan Alter, this hour, let's go to phone calls. And Brad is our first caller. Hi, Brad.
Hi there. I wanted to mention that Max Bock has hired a vice president from WellPoint by the name of Liz Fowler to craft his health care legislation. And promptly after doing that for him, then she went back to WellPoint to make a handsome salary. And I just learned last week that Blue Cross Blue Shield of California is raising their rates 39%. And one of their executives, Leslie Margolin, spoke out about that, about how their subscribers wouldn't be able to afford it. She was promptly removed from her position. I think this doesn't bode well for our so-called health care reform. Don't you think that if President Obama would have educated the public about single payer and pressured the Democrats like Ben Melson more so, we could have had a much better bill?
Jonathan.
I respectfully disagree. As I mentioned, I am a single-payer man. I've been writing articles in Newsweek for more than 20 years about the single-payer idea. I strongly favored a public option. But when you talked about, say, that Baucus staffer, that was not the bill. You know, the bill was written – there were so many different players and there were so many different sort of competing forces in this. The insurance companies were not happy about this by the end of the process. And you may recall that the president used some of the strongest language ever used by an American president against the private sector in his comments about insurance abuses. The bill does a lot of good things to rein in those abuses, and you know the most famous of that of which, but only one of many abuses that it reins in, is the discrimination against those with pre-existing conditions. So I'm a cancer survivor, for instance. Before the bill was passed, if I had lost my job and gotten sick again, I would have been in real trouble because it's basically uninsurable under the old status quo. There are thousands of people who maybe they get a sick kid and they lose their job. They have to sell their house. That's wrong. That's now over. That's history. This bill outlaws it. It's going to take a while for it to be implemented. And the same thing happened with Social Security, which I wrote about in my last book, when it was enacted in 1935. A lot of New Deal liberals were very upset about it, and they thought that Roosevelt was a sellout because it insured fewer than 40% of seniors and others in need. It was a racist bill. They excluded all jobs that blacks had from coverage by Social Security. And Roosevelt figured, as Obama does, you've got to start somewhere, and then you can move forward and fix the bill. And that also took about 5 years before it was implemented, Social Security. These things are complicated. The basic question which you raised is a really interesting one, which is the political one of if he had started out trying to educate the country on single payer, could they have compromised further to the left? I guess it's possible, but I think unlikely. And you have to remember that this had failed for 75 years, going back to Roosevelt. And there were a lot of ways it was going to fail again if they didn't get some buy-in at the front end and from the interest groups. That's the only way that – you got to remember when various healthcare ideas have gone through, there have always been powerful interests opposed, and they have not been, overcome. So there was some co-opting that had to take place, which I thought was a very shrewd approach. And I'm not the only one who thought that. Andy Stern, who until recently was head of the SEIU, the fastest growing, only real vital union, truly growing union in this country. Which he had it for many years, and he had been fighting for health care reform for many years. And he strongly agrees with me, even though obviously he's a single-payer guy too, that if they hadn't done this kind of rope-a-dope strategy early on and hadn't gotten this buy-in from the interests and made it seem like this was an unstoppable train that everybody should get aboard, it wouldn't have happened. So if he'd gone out there and said, I want single-payer, at that point when the Republicans said it's a government takeover, there would have been no response because it would have been a government takeover. Whereas in this case, when the Republicans said that this plan was a government takeover, that was a lie. And was it refuted for everybody? Did everybody get the point that it wasn't a government takeover? No. A lot of people thought it was. But enough knew the truth that this was in many ways, you know, similar to what the Republicans, when they had moderates, were proposing in the 1990s, people like Howard Baker and Bob Dole, enough people got that message that the bill narrowly was approved. If it had been accurately depicted as a plan by Barack Obama to have the government take over health care, even though I think that would have been the right thing to do, single payer, it's simply we would have gotten nothing. So as the president himself framed it, you don't want to make the perfect the enemy of the good. And this is a very good bill. We can talk about some of the other things that it has in it if you want.
And let's, excuse me, talk a little bit more about this because you cover this extensively. It was a huge part of his first year in office. A couple questions. One, why so much opposition to this among key members of his staff? Two, why he chose this to really concentrate on the first year in office?
Yeah, this was one of the big revelations to me as I was working on The Promise, and it just stunned me. Rahm Emanuel said to me at one point, I begged the president not to do this.
Begged the president.
Joe Biden told me, too much to do in the first year. He said that he had told the president that the American people would give him a pass if he didn't do it right away. Christina Romer, head of the Council of Economic Advisors, same thing. David Axelrod wanted to do energy first. So I asked the president, so why'd you do it? And he said, because if we didn't do it in the first year, it wouldn't happen. You got to use your political capital or you lose it. And I think he was tired of just cleaning up all of Bush's messes on Afghanistan, the economy, the bailouts, all the whole – I call it the shovel brigade, which is a line that Don Regan, who was Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, used, you know, cleaning up after the elephants. And that's a lot of what this president had to do. So he wanted to move forward on something that he could do for the American people. And he made some tactical mistakes, and it's a real Perils of Pauline story, and it was messed up in a lot of ways. In part, the question about Baucus is relevant. You know, he's very relevant to how this got off track, and the White House needed to have told Baucus earlier, as one White House aide told me, it's over, Max. They needed to say the bipartisanship is over, and they needed to move toward ramming it through faster, because what happened was, you know, they compare Congress to a sausage-making factory, which I think people in Wisconsin, you know something about, and making laws is like making sausage. You don't really want to know everything that goes into it. Well, in 2009, the whole country saw a lot of the sausage factory in Washington, and it stunk so bad that it spoiled everybody's appetite for the meal, right? So then when the sausage comes out, people aren't really willing to taste it that much. So they messed up tactically along the way. The end result is major. And we've been trying for so long. You know, liberals have wanted universal coverage for so long. If you'd said 10 years ago, hey, you're going to get 31 million Americans insured through an act of Congress, they'd say, no way, we can't do that. That's impossible. We've been dreaming about that forever. And then when it happens, it's not good enough, not good enough. There is sometimes, I think, there's a lack of realism about politics that affects at least some people on the American left.
And he secures his place in history as a result of this legislation?
You know, it's too early to know whether he's going to be a great president. I think so far he's a good president. There's 100 ways he can mess it up, but they can never take this bill away from him unless the Republicans, you know, take power in such numbers that they repeal it. And I think that's highly unlikely.
Let's go to John in Eagle River. Hi, John.
Good morning, folks.
Hey, John.
I'm from the south side of Chicago, too, and the Sox were always my favorite.
Yeah.
All right, John.
I'm a north sider, sorry.
At any rate, I have three suggestions for your pitch and then three quick questions. I have a friend, Artie Brickin, who owns a three-story sports memorabilia business, probably four blocks from the Brewers Stadium. He would outfit you head to toe in a Cubs uniform that they were using when you were nine.
Oh.
What's the store called?
I can get that information to you when I get off the phone. He's there, I know, and he's quite an interesting guy.
Well, that's a thought. I could go out there and
stealing sports memorabilia.
Go out there in full uniform. You know what they say? If I throw a strike, they might put me in the rotation. The Cubs need it.
He would probably loan you one of his balls that's worth $100,000 to pitch back then, too.
Oh, my God. So you're going to give the information to Chrissy?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Anyway,
we'll
my second suggestion is that you go dressed as a Supreme Court justice and just throw the ball real high. And
that's
then
good. You know, John Paul Stevens.
Halloween Blagojevich mask.
Oh, my God.
A low curveball.
Yeah. Well, you know, Blagojevich is a Cubs fan. He's not that. We don't like to advertise that very much.
I'm sure you do.
But the Supreme Court one, that's a good suggestion. That reminds me of recently retired Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, one of the great justices in history who hasn't been fully given his due. And he's thrown out the first pitch before, but he was actually at the game and has the ticket to prove it where Babe Ruth called his shot in 1932.
Really?
He was a kid, and that game was at Wrigley Field, the famous called shot. So that's the kind of thing from American history I love, that Justice Stevens was at the called shot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Artie also probably has a copy of that ticket for the first game you went to anyway. Let me go on to my quick questions. McCain, when he was running, the last thing he said he was going to do was freeze government spending. My question on that is, what would have happened had that happened? The second question is, what does Obama do about all this garbage about once a Muslim, always a Muslim? A friend of mine, Catholic friend of mine, said that to me, and I said, Peggy, that doesn't make sense. You know, I'm a Catholic, you're a Catholic, once a Catholic, always a Catholic. Neither of us are Catholics anymore.
Well, a couple of things. On the first question, if we had had a budget freeze in early 2009, we would have had a depression. Pretty much every economist, and this includes, you know, Martin Feldstein, who was Ronald Reagan's chief economist, they understood that there was simply no alternative to large spending in 2009 in order to prevent a depression. There's no other tools available, right? And so if you had a freeze, would have been Herbert Hoover economics, times five, because even Hoover didn't freeze spending, and he made token efforts to try to restore some vitality to the economy, and so that, you know, John Maynard Keynes got a new life, and even all those except on the extreme recognize this. In fact, McCain's own economic advisor, Mark Zandi, recognized this, and he endorsed Obama's stimulus plan. So that was some campaign rhetoric that I think was left over from when McCain was listening to former Senator Phil Graham, who was the architect of the deregulation that got us in this pickle in the first place. I have a lot of personal fondness for John McCain. Covering him in 2000 and getting to know him was one of the more interesting things I've ever done in journalism, and I just have great respect for him personally. I think he ran a terrible campaign. He would have been a hopeless president, and now he is rounding up and deporting his principals in his effort to get reelected in Arizona.
Thank you, John.
There was another.
What was the other one, John?
Oh, it was about the Muslim thing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay. First of all, your friend, once a Muslim, always a Muslim. He's never been a Muslim. The name Hussein comes from his grandfather. He's Barack Hussein Obama Jr., and that Hussein, even his father wasn't a Muslim. So, and when he was in Indonesia as a boy, his mother was an atheist. That's something they don't like to talk about very much. But, you know, she was not a believer. He did not go to a madrasa. He was not a Muslim. He basically didn't have any religion until he moved to Chicago and became an active Christian. So there's a story in this morning's paper that an increasing number of people believe that he's
one out of four.
Yeah.
One out of four.
It's hard to know what to say to these folks. I understand they have busy lives. They see that his middle name is Hussein. They see that he doesn't want to go to war with a billion Muslims worldwide. So his war is focused on al-Qaeda, and like Thomas Jefferson, who had the first dinner for Muslims in the White House in 1803, he wants, you know, to reach out to Muslims worldwide. If that leads ignorant Americans to think he's a Muslim, I can say this because I'm not running for office. That's their problem. It's his problem politically. So I do think when I read the paper today that he is going to have to do some things, maybe allow himself to be photographed more when he's coming out of church. I don't know what it is, but, you know, certain theatrical things to remind the ignoramuses out there that he's not a Muslim.
John, we'll put you on hold so you can give Chrissy the place of that sports memorabilia shop, and Jonathan can arrive in style tomorrow at the Cubs game. We need to pause. I haven't done my pause, have I? Pause for a moment. We'll return. Jonathan Alter is our guest, and we're talking about all kinds of issues. His latest book, which was just in the New York Review of Books, a long and very complimentary review by, I think it was just on Sunday, wasn't it?
Or it was a couple weeks ago. A
couple weeks ago by Frank Rich. The Promise is the book, President Obama Year One. Jonathan Alter, our guest in our Milwaukee studios. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network. Let's go to Marty next from Milwaukee. Hi, Marty.
Yes, hi, Kathleen. Thank you for having me on the show. And Jonathan, I am so grateful for you to be on the show today, because I've had a theory about the differences in between FDR's first term and Obama's first term so far, and I want to run it past you.
Sure.
In 1934, when the out elections occurred, I believe the Democrats gained in both houses. Isn't that right?
That is right, yeah. It was the only time that happened.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that happened in 34, and then it did not happen again until 1998 as a backlash against impeachment, and then the only time it happened in the first midterm of an incumbent president since 1934 was in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 in 2002. Mm-hmm. But it's very, very rare in all of those other elections and all of those intervening decades. The party out of power gains in the first midterms.
And yet, it's still striking to me that we do seem to be running on the other parallel track to the 30s in so many ways. And so now the Democrats are facing losing seats. And the theory I've come up with is that Obama was essentially elected 2 years too early. And by that I mean, if you can imagine the presidential election taking place 6 months after the crash of 1929, 1930. And imagine the state of the country where the depression or something like it has started, but nobody really knows where it's going. And the Republicans at that time can basically say, no, we've got to cut costs. We got to cut costs. If FDR had won, he would not have won with his landslide. It would have been an even bet. And there would have been carpers throughout the entire time as he tried to patch together a response to the nascent depression.
All right, I need to hold you there because we're running out of time.
That is an outstanding point. I completely agree with you. And, you know, it's one of those counterfactuals that we'll never know. But when I interviewed the president, he talked about this. He called it a counterfactual. He said, 20% unemployment is an abstraction. If we had that when he came in, if instead of unemployment being at 10%, if it had been at 20 or 25% is what it was when Roosevelt became president, then he would have looked much more heroic. But preventing a depression gets you less credit than easing a depression does, getting out of it, beginning to get out of a depression. Because if somebody doesn't lose their job, and a lot of the stimulus, $100 billion in the stimulus was for something called the State Stabilization Fund. It went to Wisconsin and other states. And I love these guys like, you know, this guy Joe Barton, who will be running our energy policy, the one who wanted to apologize to BP, you know, he'll be running our energy policy in the House if the Republicans win. He recently cut a ribbon on a clinic at home that was funded by stimulus money. He's taking credit for it, right? So all of that spending Obama would have gotten a lot more credit if we were really in the toilet at the time, you know. But instead, we were headed for trouble. As I mentioned earlier, if we'd stayed on the pace we were on, we would have been in a depression. So by getting us – by preventing it – nobody says, I still have my job. Thank you, President Obama. What people did say in the depression was, I didn't have a job and Roosevelt got me one. Thank you, President Roosevelt. So preventing people from getting laid off, which is what a lot of that stimulus money did, and they just – passed $10 billion more to prevent teacher and emergency worker layoffs. Preventing that, it's much, much harder to get credit for. So I think you're absolutely right in your analysis.
You should go see Jonathan tonight. I want to remind people he is speaking tonight at Concordia University, North Lakeshore Drive in Mequon. And if you want tickets, it's $32, but that's really a good price because you get the book, too. You get the book, you get the signed book. Tickets can be purchased by going to nextchapterbookshop.com. Again, that's tonight at 7 o'clock. We go next to Eric from Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good, good. I'd like to say that I was a recipient of the stimulus money. It did help. I think we're in need of some more. Things just don't seem to be progressing as I feel they should, and a lot of other people. I was just curious, what direction do you think Wisconsin is going in? You know, it's being in the skilled trades. It's been fairly lean. It seems like our state government puts a lot of money into the UW system. The people seem to be moving out. What do you forecast with Wisconsin as far as our job market in the blue-collar sector?
And let me add our politics, too, because we're either progressive or we're not.
Yeah, you know, I because I don't live here, I would defer to you, Eric, on this. I can't give you a well-informed answer to that question, but I do think that because of Wisconsin's history of progressivism, and you know, I'm one of those people who likes reading about, you know, Robert La Follette. You know, it's an interesting test case for American liberalism, and the you know, one of the things that has bothered me is that I think there are a certain number of American liberals who believed in what I call the magic wand theory of presidential leadership, that all they had to do was get Barack Obama elected, and then they were on Miller time, you know? Like, it's his job to get this done, and it's not our job, and we're done. And they sort of forget that he never promised that he was going to do these things alone. So this is a fight now this fall. And I think we'll see whether Wisconsin will be a real indication. In terms of the jobs outlook, because of what you've done on stem cells that Governor Doyle was pretty farsighted on, and because of the University of Wisconsin, by the way, I saw in the paper this morning in the Journal Sentinel that it had dropped in the U.S. news rankings, which is really stupid, and they shouldn't even have run that story. And I say that not just because I work for Newsweek, which is a competitor to U.S. News, but I mean, those rankings are just dumb. I mean, the University of Wisconsin is a fantastic school,
it
is a great. There was the Wisconsin idea which the founders of the University of Wisconsin were smart enough to understand 100 years before everybody else, that you can use a university system to generate good things for your state and beyond education. So I think, you know, Wisconsin's generally well situated to recover better than other parts of the country. But that doesn't mean it's easy for those who don't have jobs.
Thanks for the call. We have about 40 seconds left. Just briefly, Elizabeth Warren, I know you're a fan.
Yeah,
will she get the
nod?
Huge
fan. I hope so. I don't have any inside dope on the way it's going. I don't think anybody knows what the president's going to decide. I will be very disappointed if he doesn't. Does it mean that I'll, you know, will I get over it? Yeah, but she would be an outstanding choice, great consumer advocate, and I also think the best choice for him politically, the hardest person to mount a fight against, because the other ones who are just as liberal as Elizabeth Warren, they would be very easy to bury and defeat, and she would rally the progressive base, and I've known her for some years, and she is an outstanding public servant. She's done a great job on the oversight panel on TARP. And I wanted her for the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah, that would have been interesting. Well, you were terrific, and best of luck tomorrow. I will watch to see how you do and what you wear.
On the mound, okay.
Thanks,
thank
Jonathan.
You. This
thank
is
you.
Really fun.
Thanks. Jonathan Alter, his book is The Promise, President Obama, Year One, and it's a great book. We interviewed him about that book a little while ago. He will be tonight at Concordia University, 7 o'clock, and you should go. News coming up from NPR, and we'll return.